This is GamesAtWork.biz with Michael Martin and Michael Rowe, your weekly podcast about gaming technology and play. The thoughts and opinions on this podcast are those of the hosts and guests alone and not the opinions of any organization which we have been, are, or may be affiliated with.
This is episode 236, A Magic Leap for BotCon. Hello and welcome again to another edition of GamesAtWork.biz. This is Michael Martin, a co-host. I come in a pack of two because I'm joined here by my friend and co-host, Mr. Michael Rowe. Hey, Michael. Woo-hoo.
Hello. Good morning, good evening, good afternoon, Michael. It's good to be back now that we are back in full force.
Yes, at least for a little bit of time, you know, because you never know what's going to happen next, right?
Who knows?
Who knows? But, boy, have we got a cool show for all of you. Some things old, some things new. I don't know if there's some things red, something blue. Well, we'll figure it out. I think we have some of each of these things to share with you today. Let's get things started off right away, because this is a bit of a blast from the past that I'm sure you'll remember, too. There's a Roadshow article that stumbled across my feeds about BMW using smart glasses to enable technical drawings to be put in right in front of a technician's eyes. And it's something that's going to get rolled out across the United States in June, which is kind of now, to let those technicians that are working on your car be able to figure out what's the problem and resolve it a little faster.
Yeah, I saw this, and it's funny. I was talking to some people last week about this exact use case, even though I didn't mention, you know, which manufacturer might be doing something like this, right? Mm-hmm. And I was like, yeah, AR, overlays, glasses, this stuff's been around for a long time, and, you know, there's all kinds of examples, like taking and putting manuals and stuff in front of your technicians when working on a new car in a garage.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, we started off playing with this, was it 2007, 2008 in VR, which, of course, doesn't really work, because that's a good way to train, but not actually, that's a good way to simulate, not necessarily train, because in train, you actually want to have the components physically in front of you. And if you have your face buried in a VR helmet, that doesn't really work. But if you have an overlay in an AR environment, that's perfect, because it can point out very specifically using machine learning and visual analytics to say, hey, I see this right here, so therefore I can lock in on that and put an overlay of the component that is used to replace it.
Exactly. And that was one of the things that kind of got me excited about, you know, this use case and a variety of others like it. So just as a quick aside and an example, our washing machine was not terribly happy and needed to have some repairs done to it. And I was talking with the technician, too, about the same kind of things, that wouldn't it be great that when you call the tech line to get some advice and some guidance, that the folks on the other end of the phone might be able to see what you see, or they might be able even to hear what you hear. And because of the visual and the auditory, they might be able to then apply it to their database and go, hey, you know what? We've got examples of this exact thing that we've heard now before, and in the 90% of the cases, the problem was this bolt, or it was this flywheel, or was this thing. Apparently, these glasses do allow kind of a call home function as well, so that you can collaboratively work on a car with technicians that are back in the home office. And there's a video on the same page here about Porsche having a similar technology that they call, there's the Tech Live Look smart glasses, where the video I was just watching in the corner of my eye, had a guy scrolling around by putting his finger on the bridge, not the bridge, but the earpiece, I guess. That's the thing that kind of goes into the back, and was using a scrolling function with his finger. So not exactly looking where the eye is tracking, not exactly matching what is in the engine and calling up the right things, but and intriguing. And it's neat to see that these are the sort of use cases that are beginning to show up.
Yeah, and it's funny, as soon as you were describing the remote technician being able to see what you see and hear what you hear, the one song by the Information Society popped up in my mind, where they're actually using a clip from the 1967 episode of Star Trek called Mirror Mirror, where Spock goes, "I know what you mean, I feel what you feel." And they actually use that in the Information Society song. So very cool. Very cool.
Mind-melding stuff all the way
Yeah,
around.
yeah.
So if you're trying to mind meld and you've got a journalism degree and you want to reach your audience in a more engaging way, you might do worse than to try to consider what the folks over at Magic Leap and what CNN has done to do some similar things to what we've seen newspaper and other reporting do with virtual reality, in this case with the augmented reality space. Transforming your larger environment into a more interactive, they're calling it a spatial story. And I thought this was really intriguing. You and I both got this email because we're on the developer mailing list for the Magic Leap 1, and it was pretty cool to be able to see the kinds of ideas that can be conveyed in augmented reality and giving you choices as you go through a more immersive storytelling experience than you might otherwise do if you're just watching TV or just reading the news on whatever your favorite device is.
Yeah, you know, when I saw this come across, I won't say kicking myself because I really don't have the money to buy yet another interesting toy that I may not actually ever use. But it would have been really nice to have the actual Magic Leap to kind of test this out and see it in real time. The concept is something that makes a lot of sense when you're trying to expose more of the emotional impact of a news story than just the factual statements that a anchor can read to you with pictures in the background. The ability to give a viewer of a story capabilities of literally looking around, whether it's a disaster. The example that they talk about is the Thai cave rescue, right? To actually kind of see what did that really mean in this cave. I mean, how cramped was it? How, you know, dangerous was the path to get to the people in the cave, et cetera, right? To understand how that story kind of, and I like the phrase unfolds, because as you go through a cave, I mean, there's lots of different things that kind of unfold as the cave opening opens up into another area and kind of exposes light and what's in there, or how it shrinks back down. I can see that being used as a very powerful storytelling device in giving the news and making it much more impactful for people. I also can imagine this same technology being used in a movie setting. And there was an interesting discussion last week that I was a part of along the same line where people were talking about, you know, if you think about the capabilities of storytellers, right? And one of the things that we've talked about for well over a decade is, would virtual environments make for better movies or better stories because the participants watching the story could look at it from all angles, you know, move around, et cetera, and kind of focus where they want to. And the discussion went something to the effect of, you know, there are professional storytellers in Hollywood or in other, you know, Bollywood or wherever who really spend a significant amount of time and effort to make sure that the focus of the story becomes the focus of the viewer. And when you open up the environment to where you can look at everything at all time, how do you keep the story going forward in a way that's still compelling? Think about it. You know, you're driving down. Oh, no, I'll give a better example. You're flying across country, and you're flying over the Grand Canyon, right? And there's a great comedian who talked about, you know, how pilots hated her because it was like, okay, all the people on the left side of the plane look out and you'll see the Grand Canyon. Don't tell the people on the right side of the plane, right? Because, you know, this is just for you on the left side of the plane. And I started thinking about that from a storytelling perspective. And the focus of the camera in a story is pretty important because it kind of leads the people down the path of the narrative of the story. And when you expose all 360 degrees as an area where the viewer can focus, you have the opportunity to miss part of the story. And yes, it's kind of interesting and compelling from a technology perspective, and we all kind of think this will be cool one day. But if you're trying to tell a narrative, that's different, I think, than trying to expose a environment. What do you think?
You know, the control over the camera is reserved for the director until and unless you come into an immersive environment. And I kind of like the terminology that the Magic Leap and CNN are using here around spatial storytelling, which provides that degree of freedom that allows for the attention of the consumer of the experience to determine what it is that they're experiencing. So I think you've got an excellent point there, Michael, that it's easy to miss something, and you might not know that you missed it unless you had something like, remember Dragon's Lair? That video game?
Where it was on rails.
Yeah, exactly. So you get a signal that's like, hey, there's something over here. You should check this out. And it would have to be a time-based thing, a temporal thing, as well as a place and space based thing to say, okay, at, you know, minute whatever in the story, something's about to happen over here. And if you are distracted by looking at the scenery or the crowd or, you know, whatever, you're going to miss something that was actually what the director wanted you to see.
It's kind of like in The Matrix where he's talking about the woman in the red dress, right?
Mm-hmm.
In the crowd where everybody's kind of wearing black suits or black dresses or whatever. And then there's the woman in the red dress. Well, of course, that's where you naturally look, but so that may not be the important thing.
Right. And you miss the gorilla.
Yeah.
So intriguing stuff. And I think this actually moves us really well into a tweet that actually Ian had retweeted, I guess it was yesterday, maybe, about the HoloLens, and an intriguing article from Alex Kipman in ZDNet that he was focused on about how universities are taking advantage of the Microsoft HoloLens. So if we kind of follow that rabbit hole just a little bit, the nice thing here is that because Microsoft can seed into a number of universities their hardware and say, here, give it a shot. Let's see what you come up with. I guess it's not entirely surprising that so many ways it was used for creating labs and for teaching and learning experiences. But there are a couple of intriguing ways that researchers were taking advantage of the environment too. Not the least of which was the Honey, I Shrunk the Kids structure of being able to do the medical examinations, that you could make small things much bigger and you're able to manipulate them and work with them too, or to take advantage of deconstructing an environment, such as what the folks in Montreal were doing. PhD students from Waterloo and the University of Toronto to look at looking at the different layers of an urban environment and be able to deconstruct them and see more 3D X-ray vision wise into what the environment actually is that you can't normally see because you're only looking at the surface layers.
So, yeah, I always think of the 1966 movie Fantastic Voyage on these examples, right? Mm-hmm. Where they injected the scientists and the doctors into the bloodstream to repair. I can't even remember what the disease or problem was for a famous politician or something like that. Because I remember watching this one as a kid. I mean, the ability to shrink down to the size that you can see individual cancer cells and their interaction with the rest of the body is, you know, kind of a perfect example of, you know, leveraging something like HoloLens to reverse that and make that cancer cell in the structure of the body gigantic in front of you so you can actually understand the interactions.
Yes, exactly. So like I said earlier, it was not really a surprise that in many cases this is all done via learning examples, and it's not a big surprise too that you have a hardware and software vendor like Microsoft approaching universities and saying, "Here, take advantage of our development kit. Take advantage of the hardware. We're curious to see what you can do with it." I suspect that we're going to find even more intriguing things coming out of this in future too. So I liked looking at this, and it made me kind of happy. So.
Yeah. I mean, and think about it. It makes sense to start with learning, because we begin with learning as a way not only to test out the technology and see what they come up with, but as setting up the framework that ultimately ends up in industry and business and healthcare as a way to then leverage that new learning technology, right? That new learning framework. And so by investing in and donating to universities and schools to test out these new capabilities, it kind of allows for the natural buildup of the ecosystem that will be there once those same people going through school get out of school, right? They'll expect to leverage that technology. So I think it's a brilliant move. It makes sense, and it allows us to experiment in a low-risk environment with new ways of leveraging AR.
Exactly. Love it. So as we switch from the various mixed reality kind of examples that we started with and get into more real reality, you found a really intriguing article about some of the things that Amazon's doing in robotics and delivery. So,
yeah, this was an example of their updated delivery drone that they unveiled at the Mars conference in Vegas recently, which, you know, in one way, it's very traditional, you know, quadricopter type design. In this case, actually, it's a hexacopter. I guess, would you call it a hexacopter?
Hexacopter
with six. But instead of flying in the way where it's flat, it's more almost like a TIE fighter flying, right? The body of it where I can only presume the package is inside of an enclosure, kind of makes it fly with six propellers at a diagonal. So it's not completely horizontal or completely vertical, but more it's a diagonal, which gives it more control. And then with onboard capabilities, they're able to react to unexpected situations while flying. So it's not tethered to the cloud or to some kind of network, but it actually can use local sensors to do some level of local navigation. Supposedly, the design is 15 miles and 5 pounds. So that's pretty significant when you think of the number of distribution centers. Not necessarily Amazon distribution centers, but just distribution centers as a whole spread out over an urban environment. That should give it fairly good reach and capabilities. And it's a little bit different than what they showed a couple of years ago, which was much more plane-like with, you know, three rotor fins and kind of a square shape where you can imagine the box sitting underneath it. But one thing that was not clear, like I said, I assume the package is stored inside of it, was really package placement, right? So that was a little unclear for me from the videos and from the article, but I can imagine them scaling this thing up and down for different size packages. It implies point-to-point delivery. So if I have 1,000 deliveries to come out of my distribution center today, depending on flight time and number of locations, I could, in theory, have as many as 1,000 of these if each of them only flew once a day. If it's, you know, 15 miles and it takes them 20 minutes, maybe you can deliver, you know, the same with 200. I'm just making up numbers, obviously.
Yeah.
But I do like the approach as a way of doing delivery. And if it is point to point, that reduces the problems with, you know, it delivers to me and I open it up and my neighbor's package or somebody a couple blocks away's package is in there and I grab it, right? So making sure that the right package is delivered to the right person seems to be, you know, dependent on the size of the of what it can hold, right? And none of that is described in the article, but I do find it interesting that they're really improving the ability to deliver, the range. And 5 pounds is a pretty decent package size, don't you think?
Oh, it is. And, you know, just kind of looking at this a little bit more, it looks like it would be able to do it in any kind of weather. You're able to maintain the integrity of the package in that center part of the TIE fighter here. What's more intriguing to me, I think, in the end is what is the last meter? You know, we always talk about the last mile, but what's the last meter of the delivery experience going to look like? Because if this got close enough to of someone's front door, you know, could it
fling it out? Well, if you've watched all the, you know, the front door cameras that people have and the delivery people who literally toss stuff up on the porch, I mean, I've actually seen ours do it. Yeah. But you found another article about their robots that they're doing from a testing perspective on more crawler type robots. What was that about?
Yeah, so your article kind of reminded me about what Amazon is doing on lots of different spaces and places. I mean, this is really agile development when you think about it. It's like, okay, one if by air, two if by land, and robot with wheels. So Amazon has apparently built out a sample neighborhood so that it could try out.
Welcome to my sample neighborhood.
Yeah, exactly. It could actually try to drive around in the neighborhood, dealing with curbs, dealing with a whole range of obstacles to get the little robot guy where it needs to go. And between this one and the flying one, I mean, another idea that kind of entered my mind is there is a business model here that deals with Bird and many of these rechargeable scooter kind of situations where it's impossible for a company to have enough people on the ground all the time to go and manage all these robots now that are doing what they're doing. So wouldn't it be interesting to say, okay, now you can have an Amazon app. It can help you find where the destination is of a parked robot or a parked, you know, flying drone. You pick them up, you take them home, you charge them up, and then they will move on their merry way from where you are, and you'll get compensated because you picked them up and you plugged them in. So I think there's some interesting business models that we're going to see emerge in terms of not just a delivery, because 15 miles, that's kind of short when you think about it. So 7 miles out, 7 miles in. You know, maybe there will be a truck that drives around, kind of like the Ford example we talked about the other day, where it deploys robots and then it comes back. I don't know. We'll see.
Yep.
Intriguing stuff.
Very cool. I really do think, as you said, it's kind of agile development. It's kind of startup mentality. Just throw a bunch of different things at the wall, see which ones stick and which ones scale.
Yeah, I'm with you. So you and I both showed our love of Lego and Star Wars in two different ways, I think, for this show. And there's some fun stuff with all the attention coming out for Star Wars recently. There's a new Lego game, and the Gizmodo article by James Whitbrook talks about how excited he is for the new Lego version of the game versus the Jedi Fallen Order.
Is he the guy dancing in the little video?
he might be. He'd be dancing with joy.
That's Ren.
So what I thought was really cool about this is that apparently it's going to take all of the Star Wars franchises and encompass them in one game, which would be really pretty cool.
Well, I've got the first 6-episode Star Wars Lego mega game, right? Had it on the Wii, and I think I got it on the desktop now. So basically, they're doing all 9 of them. The question is, did they redo some of the early ones, or is it just add 3 more? But I love the trailer, right? I mean, it's great. Especially my favorite part is when Darth Vader chops off Luke Skywalker's hand, and in
And then offers
Legoland, that
him
means
his
he
own.
pulls his hand out, right? And he
Yeah.
pulls his off and goes, "Hey," and hands
Have a
it to him.
hand.
The team that's been making the Lego games has been doing just an unbelievably fantastic job of rendering movies and other environments in Legos in these games. I love it. I can't wait to see this one once it comes out. I think they announced it at E3 recently. So this should be lots and lots of fun. And I can't wait.
Actually, I stand corrected. So the second one is not a game; it's actually a kit,
And it's not Star Wars.
and it's not Star Wars. So I got myself somehow mixed up in all this, but it's
I
kind
wasn't going to
of,
call it out.
yeah.
It
Well,
is Lego,
it is
though.
Lego, so that this counts for that. So Jurassic World, what grabbed your attention for this one, Michael?
Well, I mean, it's Lego. Come on. That was really cool. And
Yeah.
what really got me was the design of the T-Rex. If you really look closely at how it's designed, I mean, there's lots of unique pieces on this sucker. And to some degree, the pieces reminded me of the old Fischer-Technik kits. But I think it's awesome. I mean, Lego sets that match movie sets make a lot of sense to me, as I was just mentioning from the game perspective. But the design of this one is actually really cool. They even have the famous toilet.
Yeah.
Where the one guy gets caught on. I thought it was a cool design, right? You've got the entrance gateway, you've got the rooms, I think, are actually on the back of the entrance gateway is the way it's designed. You've got the giant T-Rex, you got a lot of the characters in it. So I just thought it was a cool Lego kit that would be fun to play with.
I like all the computers. I think that's kind of cool in the computer lab, and apparently
And
there's like
who
a
does not
mini
want a
fig.
mini Samuel Jackson Lego minifig? Come on.
Yeah. Or the mini little dinosaur too, which is
Where?
like half the size. If you look at the characters when they're all together, on the left-hand side there's like a teensy little dinosaur puppy or whatever.
Oh yeah, I didn't even catch him.
That's super cool. Love it.
Yep.
All
Well,
right.
speaking of super cool,
Yeah.
you found Neal Stephenson's latest book.
Yeah, his books surface entirely too often in my consciousness, and I feel really good that I've been able to do a fair amount of reading here recently, more so than I have maybe in the last year almost. And I was looking something up, and I think I was looking up Snow Crash, or I was looking up something different. And it's like, oh, look at this. Neal Stephenson has a new book. It's called Fall. And it's I don't want to even spoil much more than that. I mean, you may have a couple of things that you're taking away, but I'm super excited to know that there's another new book that's out there, and I'm looking forward to making a trip to the bookstore this weekend and picking up a copy.
Yeah, I've liked all of his books that I have read, I've enjoyed. They do tend to be a bit long, but after reading a gazillion pages of George R. R. Martin, I guess anything, less than 1,000 pages is a quick read. however, like you, I have been trying to do reading up again, but unlike you, I've just I've had so little time. I'm still reading the same book that I started the year with, which is just horrible, between work and other things going on, and my nonprofit. I just really don't have enough time. And now, after last week, which we'll talk about shortly, I've got a whole slew of other reading that I need to do, and that my summer has been booked up with. But this one looks really good, especially this won't give it well, I don't. It's a story about the book. It doesn't tell you anything about it. The key thing about it is kind of a near future setting, talking about what the world could end up being when you bifurcate the internet into a set of closed off areas with their own rules and their own impact as it relates to social media and the news. And, you know, all these topics are really interesting to me, and I can't wait to read this one.
Yep. I think part of this for me is that there's a saying that science fiction is a great way to predict the future, because when you take a look at what people are imagining the future might be like, it just provides you with all kinds of intriguing ideas. So maybe to wrap things up, Michael, you've spent last week getting exposed to all kinds of new ideas.
Yes.
You know, how your watch may be able to tell you that things are too loud around you. Or
well, actually, it was really funny because so I was at WWDC last week, second year in a row. Fantastic time. The keynote that most people who follow this type of stuff actually probably saw or at least read up about was so nonstop packed with detail that the 2 hour, 20 minute or whatever it was just seemed to fly by, and they couldn't go deep really on anything.
Right.
Which usually they'll have one or two things where they kind of go deep because they just don't have that much content. It was unbelievably packed. And out on my blog, you'll see, you know, a 4 day detail and a fifth day wrap up on WWDC. The most exciting things to me personally, which is why I said I will not have any time this summer to do anything, are the implementation by Apple. So WWDC is the Worldwide Developers Conference for Apple. The introduction of Swift UI, which is a new UI framework that is the same framework across all of Apple's platforms, starting at the watch as the smallest platform, going up to the TV as the largest platform, and everything in between, Mac, iPad, iPhone, watch, you name it, which should greatly simplify applications handling different screen sizes correctly. And rendering in such a way that is not as complex and error prone as things like auto layout. So that was really interesting, and I already am working on an app that I started last year that I need to finish the UI on, so I may just gut the UI and redo it in Swift UI. The second thing that I found really interesting is something called Combine. Last summer, when I was adding voice controls to my Wasted Time app, I switched over to something called React Native, React Swift, which is based off of React Native, which is a way of having your application dynamically, asynchronously react to data changes. What does that mean? That means when an object updates data within it, the UI dynamically reacts to it. Okay. RX Swift is based off of React Native, which came out of, I believe, Facebook as a way of doing this across platforms. Combine makes that a native feature now in Swift, which means all that work that I did last summer, I need to rip out and replace with this. And then the third part that I found just completely fascinating is something called Catalyst. Last summer, Apple showed off a proof of concept of taking a iPad app and making it run on the Mac. That was something that they called Marzipan last year. And in the last year, they have done major improvements and corrections, et cetera, to that concept to create Catalyst. And Catalyst allows you, if you have a quote-unquote well-behaved iPad app, to flip a switch and have a native Mac app. And so between Swift UI, Catalyst, and Combine, I should completely rewrite Wasted Time, my one app, so that I can finally have a native Mac version of it, iPad version of it, phone version of it, And what I've been trying to do for about 3 years now, playing around, which would be a watch version of it. Now, the great thing is watchOS 6 is now designed to be completely independent of the iPhone. So you can write native watch apps without having it connect up to any other device. There is a watch app, app store, etc. And so really, really excited about all of this. And I can't decide what I'm going to work on.
Too many things, huh?
Too many things that are all too exciting. And all of them are ways of improving my knowledge of iOS and the Mac. And it was an incredible time. The concert on Thursday night was Weezer. Had a good time at that. Met up with a group of iOS developers that we've been chatting together for a couple of years on Slack in an iOS developer channel. People from US, UK, Denmark, Germany, Lebanon, Russia, China, Japan. I know I'm missing a couple of countries in there, but had just an incredible time. And again, no sleep. lots of fun technical discussions and lots of really good things that were learned by all.
Wow. Well, seems like you got a ton of benefit out of this this week, Michael. I'm excited to see how all the new ideas begin to creep their way into the apps that you're working on. That's awesome.
It'll be fun.
Yep.
Well, I think we're right out of time, unless there's a game you've been playing lately.
Actually, there is. I'll drop it in the show notes, too. It's one called Sprout. So my kids and I have been playing this. It's a little planting game, and you plant flowers and you have gardeners go around and pick them. And when you level up, you can plant different flowers, and it's kind of cool.
Very cool. Well, don't forget to follow us on the various social media, whether that's Facebook or at Twitter at games@work_biz, or over at our blog at gamesatwork.biz. We'd love to hear from you, and keep letting us know what you want to hear about on the show.
Thanks, Michael. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next time.
Bye. You've been listening to gamesatwork.biz, the podcast about gaming technology and play. We are part of the Blueberry Podcasting Network, and we'd like to thank the band Random Encounters for their song, Big Blue. You can follow us on Twitter at gamesatwork_biz or at our website at gamesatwork.biz.